Hey, we'll get started. We seem to be running out of time. I think in order to make sure that all the panelists have equal time, we will run to about 12:15. It's my pleasure to introduce our last panelist this morning, Mr. Justice Lissick, who has spent a lot of time as an academic, but his career has been much more varied than that. He was with the Privy Council Office federally for a year. He has acted as the Deputy Minister of Justice in Saskatchewan. He was there for 4 years. He's also Dean of UBC Law School, and has been appointed to the bench, was appointed to the bench 6 years ago in British Columbia. He, during the course of his career, he has argued several Supreme Court of Canada cases, and of course, everybody from the Yukon knows him as head of the famous pipeline inquiry in 1977. He is going to talk to us about the charter rights in the Yukon, and I'm going to listen with great interest, and I'd like you to welcome Mr. Justice Lissick.
Thank you very much for those kind remarks, Mr. Chairman. And let me say that it's a great pleasure to be back in the Yukon. It's now, in fact, over 10 years since my last visit up this way, and it is an occasion to get back that I look forward to with much anticipation. It's one of my favorite parts of the country, and it's nice to be back even in January. And mind you, I think I should get a refund. You call this January weather, for heaven's sake? It's practically tropical. So, that's right. I accepted, therefore, the Planning Committee's invitation to come with alacrity, and my only hesitation had to do with finding a suitable subject to lay on you this morning, one that would be in keeping with the theme of the conference, and meet one or two other requirements. For one thing, as you know, people in my line of work are supposed to avoid topics that are controversial, politically charged, that is to say, that are interesting in any way at all. So much for Meech Lake, so much for the Yukon Land Claim Framework Agreement and so on, but of course you've had the benefit of excellent presentations on that, so we need to feel no regret. Well, what would be left? You know, there could be I could give you a barn burner on one of those old standbys like rule of law and judicial independence, somewhat sufficiently safe, if somewhat soporific. But you know, how in the world do you put a northern spin on rule of law? And it should be a topic, I thought, in which I could at least plausibly pretend to be somewhat informed. And that's where it got really difficult, because what could this outsider say, who hasn't set foot up here for a decade, that wouldn't be old hat or hopelessly out of touch on the subject of Yukon's constitutional status? Well, anyway, as you see from my billing on the program, I do propose to say a couple of things about the charter rights. And as it may have some special impact or interest in the Yukon. And I thought I might at least begin by identifying a few matters that have a particular pertinence to the territories, and then, if time permitted, that I would talk to you about one or two other matters that have no particular geographic hook, but to me at least seem to be of interest with respect to the Charter. And that was the if time permitted, and we'll see what time permits when I get to that point in my remarks, but I think perhaps the part of my presentation might drop by the wayside. Well, let me begin by reminding you briefly about what the Charter says specifically about the territories, the 34 sections which make up the Charter have two provisions, and they're referred to by Mr. Willis. Section 30 is the is the key one, and just let me read it quickly. A reference in this charter to a province or to the legislative assembly or legislature of a province shall be deemed to include a reference to the Yukon Territory and the Northwest Territories, or to the appropriate legislative authority thereof, as the case may be. Well, this seems straightforward enough. For purposes of the charter, the territories are equated to provinces, and their legislative councils are equated to provincial legislatures. Then section 32.1 of the charter, that's the applicability section, and Mr. Willis referred to that as well, subsection 1, paragraph A, that the charter applies to Parliament and Government of Canada in respect of all matters relating to the authority of Parliament, including all matters relating to the Yukon Territory and the Northwest Territories, so that what Ottawa has to say about the Yukon is caught by paragraph A, and then B, by virtue of the section 30 formula that province includes territory, catches what the Yukon legislature and government does. B, to the legislature and government of each province, read Yukon, in respect of all matters within the authority of the legislature, legislative council of each province or territory. So those are the explicit provisions. On the face of the charter, therefore, it seems that the Yukon and, of course, the Northwest Territories are subject to the same constraints and generally stand in the same position as the provinces. For example, Section 6 of the Charter, which deals with mobility rights, guarantees the right to move and take up residence in any province and to pursue the gaining of a livelihood in any province. Subsection 4 allows the giving of a preference to residents of a province to ameliorate conditions of individuals who are socially or economically disadvantaged, but only if the rate of employment in that province is below the rate of employment in Canada. Well, for province, one may read Yukon, so presumably the government of Yukon is precluded from giving or requiring preference in hiring to resident Yukoners, whether or not they're socially disadvantaged, unless the Yukon's unemployment rate is higher than the national average. And that's a provision of the charter that would have had some impact with respect to some of the recommendations that we made in the pipeline report that Gordon referred to. On the other hand, the Yukon presumably has the same rights under the charter as does a province. For example, to invoke the notwithstanding clause provided for by Section 33 that overrides certain charter rights, not including Section 6, but extending, and you know all this, to the fundamental freedoms that are guaranteed by Section 2, the legal rights guaranteed by Section 7 to 14, and the equality rights guaranteed by Section 15. Now let me turn to some situations in which the charter may impact differentially as between the Yukon and the provinces, or some of them. First, language rights. To start with the obvious, the extent to which the Constitution guarantees or protects language rights across the country is not uniform. The subject is complex, and the result is not always capable of being predicted with confidence. Witness the decision of the Supreme Court of Canada in Mercure, that was last February. That was an appeal from Saskatchewan, and the Supreme Court divided with the majority coming to a result different from that in the courts below. That was on the question of whether language rights violated or came into conflict with Section 110 of the Northwest Territories Act, and whether that provision of the Northwest Territories Act had survived the creation of a province in 1905. The majority of the Supreme Court decided that Section 110 of the Northwest Territories Act remained in force, with the result, among other things, that statutes enacted in Saskatchewan since 1905 were ultra vires. However, the court also recognized that it was open to the Saskatchewan legislature to repeal Section 110 of the Northwest Territories Act and to pass a bilingual statute retrospectively validating the laws enacted since Saskatchewan became a province, and Alberta would be in a comparable position. Now, any treatment of constitutional language rights involves much more extensive treatment than I certainly can presume to give to it, even by touching on it. But any sort of treatment involves some sort of a categorization, and just let me try that very quickly. There are at least five different constitutional categories of language rights. First, there are those which are the subject of constitutional provisions other than the Charter. That would include Section 133 of what we used to call the BNA Act, the of 1867, Constitution Act 1867, concerning the use of French and English in the federal and Quebec legislative bodies and courts. The counterpart provision in the Manitoba Act, Section 23, and Section 110 of the Northwest Territories Act that I referred to a moment ago. Those are all independent, of course, of the Charter. Secondly, there are the Charter provisions that relate to English and French as the official languages of Canada and New Brunswick. New Brunswick, of course, being the only province which is officially bilingual. Those are Section 16 to 20, and Section 21 continues other provisions relating to those two official languages found elsewhere in the Constitution of Canada. The third category relates to languages other than English or French. So that's Section 22 of the Charter. It preserves any legal or customary rights or privileges acquired before or after the coming into force of the Charter with respect to any other language. Fourth, there are the French and English language educational rights set out in Section 23 of the Charter. And then now, as a result of the recent decisions out of the Supreme Court of Canada with respect to Quebec's Bill 101, it's clear that there's a fifth category, at least, of language rights, and they arise from Section 2, B of the Charter, which protects freedom of expression. And it's clear that for purposes of the Freedom of Expression Clause, it's not necessary to differentiate between the official languages and other languages. So there's a great deal of law out there relating to constitutional language rights, and it appears to be a growth industry. No doubt we'll have, if we don't already have it, a languages bar growing up in the country. But what's the present state of play in the Yukon? That, I think, can be dealt with fairly briefly. In the Saint-Jean case that Mr. Willis referred to, Mr. Justice Meyer considered the law relating to the official languages. That was one of those speeding ticket cases. The challenge was based on the tickets being issued in English only and being based on an act that was enacted in English only. The accused was convicted, and Mr. Justice Meyer dismissed the appeal. Now, in that case, the non-charter argument had to do solely with Section 133 of the Constitution Act of 1867. Judge Meyer pointed out that Section 110 of the Northwest Territories Act had applied to the Yukon Territory when it was created out of the Northwest Territories in 1898, but Section 110 was repealed. For purposes of Section 133 of the Constitution Act of 1867, the broad question raised was whether the Yukon ordinances or acts in question relating to motor vehicles and to summary convictions were to be considered a form of federal delegated legislation, bringing them within the phrase Acts of Parliament of Canada within Section 133. Answered that question in the negative, and in the course of doing so, he made some interesting remarks about the status of Yukon enactments and the institutions of Yukon government. For example, he expressed the view, and Mr. Willis referred to this, expressed the view that that there was a striking parallel between municipal bodies and the Yukon territory, but also substantial difference. And later in his reasons, he pointed out that the Yukon territory is not a department of the federal parliament or the federal government, and that in his view, it's a, and these are his words, infant province with most but not all of the attributes of a true province. So he concluded that Section 133 did not apply to the ordinances or the acts of the Yukon Territory. He also dealt with a charter argument that was based on Sections 16.1, 18.1, and 21. The central question in his view was whether the Yukon Commissioner in Council is an, and this is from the wording of of Sections 16 sub 1 and 20 sub 1, an institution of the Parliament or Government of Canada. He concluded that the Commissioner in Council was not such an institution, and therefore these charter provisions relating to the official languages did not apply. Now, I understand an appeal has been filed from the decision of Mr. Justice Meyer. A date for hearing has not yet been set, I'm told, and I'm further advised that on December 17th, intervener status was granted to the Commissioner for Official Languages. So there may be some further developments before that matter is finally resolved. Turning to languages other than the two official languages, I've mentioned that Section 22 of the Charter does not, by its terms, create any new rights, but preserves legal or customary rights or privileges relating to them, whether acquired before or after the Charter came into force. Now, so far as I'm aware, there have been no decisions as yet relating to Section 22, either here in the Yukon or elsewhere in the country. Particularly interesting here, perhaps, is the constitutional protection given not only to legal but to customary rights or privileges. Perhaps in the discussion period, someone may wish to offer a view as to whether in the Yukon there are presently such customary language rights or privileges which would be recognized in the courts. With respect to language and educational rights, Section 23 would seem to apply here as it does in the rest of the country. It relates to the two official languages only, and I don't think it requires comment. The last category, perhaps just make one or two observations about, that's the freedom of expression category of language rights that flows now from these recent decisions out of the Supreme Court of Canada in Singer and Brown's Shoes. Decisions hold that the freedom of expression includes the right to express oneself in one's own language, and it extends to commercial expression by corporations as well as by individuals. So it includes signs in stores and commercial establishments and so on. Now, as you know, there's been a great deal of fallout from these decisions. They raise some fascinating issues as to how one reconciles individual rights with group rights, use of the notwithstanding clause, judicial versus governmental attempts to find a compromise, and so forth. The Supreme Court as you'll be aware, held that requiring exclusive use of Quebec's official language, French, violated the freedom of expression clause. The court suggested a compromise, and was this, that it said, indicated that so far as provided dominant, one apparent exception is this. I don't think I've seen anyone write or heard anyone say that a storekeeper's ability to sell his cornflakes or a customer's ability to find where the cornflakes are kept is really going to be significantly affected by whichever one of these policy options is chosen. So it is very high in symbolic content and perhaps not so very much so in terms of what actually happens in the stores. The proposed Bourassa compromise appears to have enraged militants on both sides of the issue. For some Francophones, it represents a dangerous erosion of the protection necessary to preserve the island of French Canadian culture and patrimony in a sea of Anglophones in North America. For some non-Francophones, it represents delegating English and other languages to second-class status, and by association, the people who use these other languages. I doubt very much whether there is any form of compromise which could have avoided attracting heavy flak from the militants on both sides of that issue. Whether it be the Bourassa compromise or the suggested Supreme Court of Compromise or any other middle ground. And I leave to you to consider the heavy philosophical question as to whether that sort of highly charged political issue is really more appropriately handled by the courts or by the legislature. A nice, relatively clear legal principle for the courts to draw upon. Here there were at least two at opposite ends of the spectrum. One would be a clear result flowing from a finding that the freedom of expression clause did not extend to signs in commercial establishments, that it did not extend to commercial expression. That would have meant that the case would be thrown out. The other clear finding of principle would be, yes, there's a right to use the language of one's choice in the way that one chooses, not in the case of posters, big letters and small letters, that sort of compromise, or one can imagine verbal compromises. You can use one language at the top of your lungs and the other sotto voce. These may make good sense. They may be good workable compromises, but they're very difficult ones for a court to develop. Well, no doubt it's unlikely that any government of Yukon in the foreseeable future would enact legislation requiring unilingual signs or requiring the exclusive use of a specified language or languages in the private sector. The din of battle in Quebec seems very far away from Whitehorse or Vancouver, and yet because this sort of issue is one which seems capable of making or breaking government in Quebec these days, it's one which potentially affects us all. Anyway, the main point that I wanted to make with respect to this last category of case was just this. In addition to the provisions of the Constitution of Canada, including the Charter, which specifically address language rights, these recent decisions demonstrate that there is an additional dimension based on the Freedom of Expression Clause in Section 2, and that it embraces not just the official languages, but all languages, and possible particular interest in the Yukon will be with the implications or possible implications of that for the use of native languages. Now I'd like to turn to another sort of charter development with some possible implications for the Yukon and for the Northwest Territories. It relates especially to equality rights guaranteed by Section 15 of the Charter. And the problem is presented by situations in which a federal law on a particular subject is not uniform across the country. For example, where the criminal code lays down one rule for the Yukon and a different rule for British Columbia. Does that represent a form of description, represent a form of discrimination? And for lack of a better term, I'll call it geographic discrimination, which makes the law vulnerable to being struck down unless it can be justified as a reasonable limit under Section 1 of the Charter. Now, when the criminal code is mentioned in this context, the example that comes to mind has to do with the provisions of the code respecting six-person juries in the territories instead of the 12-person juries that prevail in the rest of the country. The six-person jury provisions survived earlier challenge under the Canadian Bill of Rights, but they didn't survive. They haven't survived under the Charter. Different result was reached at the trial level, different from the Canadian Bill of Rights position. A result reached consistently at the trial level in the Yukon and in the Northwest Territories was that the six-person jury provisions violated the Charter's Section 15 guarantee of the right to equal protection and equal benefit of the law without discrimination. And the same conclusion has now been reached at the appellate level. The decision is Queen and Emile in the Northwest Territories Court of Appeal. I note parenthetically that in Emile, Court of Appeal did not approve of one particular approach taken at the trial level in the Northwest Territories, where the accused was given a right to elect between a six-person jury and a 12-person jury. The Court of Appeal concluded that the six-person jury provisions were discriminatory and could not be justified under Section 1 of the Charter. Now, the Parliament of Canada, when it originally enacted those provisions, presumably thought that the conditions here in the north, with its remote communities, were sufficiently different so as to warrant differential legislative treatment respecting jury trials. Whether that assessment was sound then, or whether it might remain sound today, is a matter in which I offer no comment at all. But I do want to invite some consideration of the broader underlying constitutional principle, and it's can be formulated along these lines. Is every federal law which lays down a rule for the Yukon different from the corresponding rule it lays down for a province constitutionally suspect for that reason alone? This is, as I say, for convenience, I'll refer to that as geographic discrimination. And the law in this area is not at all settled. I want to mention just one area where it has had some recent developments. It relates to the criminal code provisions enacted in 1985. Relating to repeat offenders under the drinking driving provisions of the code. Prior to the amendment, the code said on subsequent convictions, a prison sentence was mandatory. For a second offense, it's a mandatory 14-day minimum. Subsequent offenses, it's 90 days. Now, the issue arose because the 1985 amendment was proclaimed in some jurisdictions in Canada, but not in others. It was proclaimed here in the Yukon and in the Northwest Territories and five of the provinces. It was not proclaimed in Ontario. It was not proclaimed in British Columbia. So hence this little clump of cases where the accused says, look, I'm being discriminated against because if I were being convicted for the second time in the Yukon, the judge would have the option of sending me off for curative treatment. That's the effect of the amendment, a conditional discharge and off for curative treatment, rather than the mandatory imprisonment. All right, in a case out of Ontario called the Queen and Hamilton, the Ontario Court of Appeal grappled with that argument by the accused and held that his right to equality, in fact, had been violated by this unequal application of federal law. The Court of Appeal went on to find that the appropriate charter remedy was to treat the unproclaimed amendment as if, in fact, it had been proclaimed in Ontario. So as a result, the sentencing judge in Ontario could apply the curative treatment option and did not have to send the repeat offender down the river for a couple of weeks. In the Hamilton case, leave to appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada was sought but denied. Now, on the same reasoning as that in the Hamilton case, trial courts in Alberta and Saskatchewan effectively brought into force in those provinces unproclaimed criminal code provisions providing for the right to trial by judge and jury in the French language. So it's an application, a wholly different area, of the same principle, that you can't have federal law different, applying differently as between jurisdictions in these situations arising from proclamation in some places but not others. However, the British Columbia courts have reached different conclusions with respect to both sets of criminal code provisions, those respecting trials in French and also those respecting the drinking driving provisions. The drinking driving decision was that of at the trial level, was that of the late Harry McKay of our court in a case called Queen and Hanson. He declined to follow the Ontario Court of Appeal decision in Hamilton, and he decided his case on the basis that the unproclaimed code provisions were not enforced in British Columbia. Then last month, the British Columbia Court of Appeal handed down its decision in a case called Van Vliet. This is December 9th of 1988. It, of course, isn't reported yet, but if anyone wants the Court of Appeal reference number, I'd be pleased to give it to you. And it was treated on all sides as being effectively a review of what Mr. Justice McKay at the trial level had decided earlier in Hanson. Now, Van Vliet involved the same issue, and the accused sought the same remedy as in the Ontario decision in Hamilton. That is, he wanted the court to proceed on the basis that there was an option open for him to go off for curative or be sent off for curative treatment rather than mandatory prison. The BC Court of Appeal in Van Vliet split 2-1. The majority said that it could not grant Van Vliet the kind of remedy that he sought, and it held that the Ontario Court of Appeal was wrong to have granted such a remedy in Hamilton. The Van Vliet decision is an interesting one, but it doesn't help us very much on the question of whether geographic discrimination violates Section 15 of the Charter. And that's so for this reason. The majority judgment, which was written by Madam Justice Southern, stated the Section 15 issue in the following way, and it states the issue clearly enough. Let me just read it quickly. If the remedy sought were one this court could grant, then in my opinion the question to be answered would be this: does Parliament have the right under the Constitution to bring into force in some provinces of Canada and not in others, according to the wishes of the respective provinces, an act which in those provinces in which it is enforced empowers a lighter sentence for an offense that is applicable than is applicable in the other provinces without contravening the rights under Section 15 of persons charged in those other provinces with the offense to, and quoting from Section 15, equal protection and equal benefit of the law without discrimination. Now, having stated the question very clearly, Madam Justice Southern found it unnecessary to answer it. So the case was decided on another basis. She concluded that the remedy which Van Vliet sought was one which the court constitutionally could not grant. And she disagreed in vigorous terms with what the Ontario Court of Appeal had done in Hamilton. And let me just read the sentence in which she does that. She says, with the greatest of respect, and all the lawyers here know that's a setup. It's bad enough when the sentence begins with respect, but when it starts with the greatest respect, watch out. With the greatest of respect, I say that the judgment of the Ontario Court of Appeal is as offensive to our constitutional system as was the King's assertion that by divine right he could do as he pleased. Period. So she went on for the majority to conclude that the court ought not to consider whether, if he had asked for some other remedy, in fact there hadn't been breach of Section 15. She specifically left that question wide open. One alternative remedy that Van Vliet could have asked for, she pointed out, was the declaration that the code provision providing for differential treatment, proclamation differentially, was ultra vires. Of course, that's the exact opposite of what Van Vliet wanted. He didn't want the section held ultra vires. He wanted it put into force. But the tough constitutional question has been defined, but it's not been answered. And again, in broad terms, the question is any federal law which, by the terms of the law itself, like the six-person jury provisions, or by providing for proclamation into force on a differential basis, like these drinking driving provisions, the trials in French provisions, and so on, are all those constitutionally vulnerable under Section 15? As you know, the Supreme Court of Canada has yet to deliver its first decision on Section 15. When it does, maybe it will be of some help on governing principles, including whether geographic discrimination is a relevant kind of discrimination at all for purposes of Section 15. Obviously, it's not one of the listed grounds of discrimination that Section 15 talks about, but is also clear, at least in the lower court decisions, that that's not a closed list. Mr. Chairman, I'll just wind up in the next minute or two here with the other possibility, of course, is that an appeal might now be both sought and granted in the Van Vliet case. Obviously, there's deep division between two courts of appeal, at least on a very precise issue, and all sorts of confusion and chaos on other issues in the lower court. There was, as I mentioned, a dissent in Van Vliet, so it seems to be an appropriate case. And in fact, my information may be dated. It may be that an appeal has been sought. I don't expect it would have been dealt with so promptly. And I've talked, of course, about geographic discrimination in terms of differential application of federal law. The same principle could be raised with differential application of a territorial law within the Yukon. Same question of principle would arise. Special enactment or regulation of some sort applicable to Old Crow, treated differently from Whitehorse. Is that constitutionally suspect? Well, if Section 15 of the Charter is ultimately held to preclude Parliament and the legislatures from passing laws which treat people in one province or territory differently from those or another, or one part of a territory differently from those in another part of the territory, that would obviously represent a significant reduction in federal legislative authority and a significant reduction in flexibility insofar as application of policy measures is concerned. It also raises, and this would be my concluding observation, if these matters do stay with the courts, it raises potentially raises very difficult issues. Once you pass that first step and you say, all right, the law is different. Let's use the jury example. There are 12-person juries south of 60 and 6-person juries up here. So there's a difference. That much is obvious. But which one do you strike down? Or do you strike them both down? Of course, you have to go through the analysis. The court has to go through analysis on one basis or another. You say, well, one is better than the other, or less discriminatory for purposes of Section 15 in terms of the effect. And that kind of analysis happens, of course, in the jury cases. In other areas, especially non-criminal code matters, where in the criminal code matters, it's perhaps a little easier to say, well, which measure is most favorable to the accused? And that the one that is less favorable is the one which we'll treat as discriminatory and strike down. With respect to other kinds of federal legislation, the analysis is apt to be a little bit tougher. Well, Mr. Chairman, I said early on that I had originally thought, if time permitted, to talk about other aspects of the Charter, but I note the time, and I'm sure everyone is anxious to have this brought to an end. If there is a question or two, I'd be pleased to try and cope with it.
I'd just like to mention on the question or discussion aspect that the in the